for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss the valuable work of federal employees with Congressman John Sarbanes. We'll also be joined by Congressman John Yarmuth and Newsweek and Daily Beast contributor Eleanor Clift to examine the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And later, Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare will discuss the importance of SSA employees.
I've been joined by Congressman John Sarbanes from Maryland. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Jason. I appreciate it.
So we have you here on Radio Row at the Health Action 2012 conference by Families USA. Give us a little insight as to what you're doing.
Well, this is a great opportunity to sort of coalesce a lot of positive energy on important issues that face the country. Healthcare is obviously a keen focus of this gathering, but there's many issues that I care about that we need to keep advocating on strongly, particularly in this very important 2012 election year.
One of the things that is a passion for you is money and politics and campaign finance reform. Tell us about your work on that.
There's a bill called Fair Elections Now Act, which is an effort to create a public financing system at the federal level, which I'm a very strong supporter of. You know, there's sort of two tracks that people are operating on right now, and we can do that simultaneously. One is to pursue a constitutional amendment to address the disastrous ruling in the Citizens United case, which claimed that were certs and has now made the law that corporations should be treated as natural persons when it comes to the First Amendment, which is unleashing this torrent of special interest money and corporate money coming into campaigns. We're just starting to see this now in the presidential election. But the effect that can have at the congressional level in races across the country is going to be incredible in this coming cycle. So we got to pursue a response to the Citizens United case in terms of what the Supreme Court did. But even before Citizens United, we had the problem of special interest having really a stranglehold on the legislative machinery in Washington because of the resources that they can distribute. And so we need to pursue public financing where the people basically are the ones that take ownership again and say, we will support candidates in these races across the country.
What kind of support are you getting for that public finance and to remove a lot of this special interest money out of politics?
Look, if you talk to the average person on the street, this is a no-brainer for them. We're getting a lot of resonance with this. Much of the anger and frustration out there is directed at this idea that special interests are taking over our political system. So you have broad support in the country, I think, and among the public and the electorate for it. Congress ought to be trying to meet that advocacy, and the Fair Elections Now Act has a number of co-sponsors, over 100 co-sponsors in the last Congress. We're building support for it again. In the meantime, I've started to model it in my own campaign. The way it's designed, the Fair Elections Now, is if a candidate can go recruit a certain number of grassroots donors, say 1,000 or 1,500, those are people who give under $100, then they get access to money from a public fund. Well, we don't have that in place yet, but I decided, why don't I do it in my own campaign? So we went to a bunch of traditional donors, asked them to create a special fund. I called it a challenge fund, and then I pledged to them that I would not touch those dollars until I recruited 1,000 grassroots people. So we've done this. We've created the fund. It's off limits to me until I go show that the grassroots network is in place. We got a grassrootsdonor.com is where we're putting all this effort right now. And we want to model that public financing can work and show that the average person can take control back from the special interests.
Do you think that voters would be more likely to participate in the process if they knew that it was more of a public financing situation as opposed to lots of money coming in from special interest groups? Would you think you would see voter participation shoot up?
I don't think there's any question about that, because a lot of the reason for people's cynicism and they're concluding that participating doesn't make a difference is because they think, you know, we elect these folks, they go to Washington, the special interests basically call the tune, and that's how legislation gets made. If they believed that they were sending a more independent-minded candidate to Washington because the support for their campaign was coming from the grassroots, I think they'd be much more interested in going out there, not just voting, but working for their interests.
Really being a part of the process as opposed to sitting on the sidelines and maybe saying, my vote doesn't count.
No question about it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congressman John Sarbanes from Maryland. Congressman, another one of your passionate issues is the rights of federal employees and the work that they do. Tell us a little bit about your work there.
I represent the 3rd District of Maryland, which has a number of jurisdictions that are packed full of federal employees. So I'm very focused on the needs of the federal workforce and also, frankly, very focused on the contribution that the federal workforce makes. Not just to sort of keeping our country operating, but in terms of the quality of work that they produce and the model and example that can be. And I'm very resentful when I see the federal worker being made into a scapegoat. And unfortunately, some of the leadership now in Congress, particularly on the House side, has decided they want to blame every single problem there is on the federal employee, and that when it comes to dealing with the nation's deficit and these fiscal issues that we have, you know, we have to keep going back to the well of the federal employee and asking them to give. The latest example of that is this discussion about extending the payroll tax deduction. Democrats, for the most part, and I certainly, are saying, let's pay for that by putting a surcharge on millionaires, people who've done the best in a tough economy. People have done very, very well. That's fair. The Republicans' proposal is, no, let's pay for it by going back and asking the federal employees to give up more in terms of their pension benefits or, you know, to have to contribute more on the front end. The bottom line is you're taking their compensation down. And AFGE just did a study recently that showed that over the next 10 years, concessions that the federal employees already made are going to contribute $60 billion to reducing the deficit. So let's get some other people in here to help with the program.
When you're going about your day-to-day business and you're hearing these things, why do you think that federal employees are made to be scapegoats in this conversation?
You know, there's a long tradition of sort of scapegoating and bad-mouthing the government bureaucrat. But the truth of the matter is some of the hardest working, most dedicated people I've ever met are people that are in the federal workforce. I mean, true professionals, and the service that they're performing for our country, I don't think can be overstated. When I talk to my constituents, there's a deep appreciation for what the federal workforce does. I mean, people who rely on those Social Security checks coming to them, you know, every month, they know that there's an agency out there whose mission it is to make sure those checks arrive on time, people who are served by the Veterans Administration. But then, you know, other agencies like NASA and NIH, you know, where you've really got to have the top scientists and the best and the brightest in order to move our country forward. So it's a rhetorical game that people play out there, and they always want to throw the federal employee under the bus. And we just got to push back and tell the story as it is. And frankly, the solution to our country is not to go after government workers' pensions because there are problems in the private sector. It's to say, wait a second, we ought to be trying to build a private sector pension system that is as robust as what traditionally we've been able to offer to our public employees. That's the kind of society we want to live in.
Congressman, do you see a similarity between the conversation of federal employees and the Affordable Care Act in that when people who are detractors point to it and say, no, that's not a good idea, once you explain to them almost piece by piece, point by point in the Affordable Care Act, job by job, federal employees, the work that they do, that you get more buy-in, that you get more understanding and support?
It's very easy to dumb down these issues, right, and to turn them into slogans. And I think the detractors, whether it's of the federal employee or the health care legislation or any other thing that I would regard as a positive initiative, those detractors know that the average person today gets bombarded from all sides with media. People generally have a short attention span. And if you can put it into these sound bites, that can be very effective, particularly if they're negative sound bites. It's hard to push back against that. But it's not impossible. I've frankly been articulating in recent months this an overarching framework, a narrative that says what we're about is trying to rebuild our country and make it strong again. And that means investing in infrastructure, physical infrastructure, but also human capital, civic infrastructure, and investing in good government, government that can provide good services to people and can restore people's faith in our institutions. And that's all about rebuilding the country and making it strong. That's a powerful narrative that I think we can offer as we move into this election cycle. And there's going to be clear choices to be made this fall. And I trust the American people do the right thing.
Congressman John Sarbanes from Maryland, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll look at the implementation of the Affordable Care Act with Congressman John Yarmuth.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Congressman John Yarmuth from the 3rd District of Kentucky. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So, of course, we're here at the Health Action Now conference put on by Families USA. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing here.
Well, I'm here to talk about the Affordable Care Act and what I think will be the enormous benefits it provides for virtually every American. I was proud to be a part of that 111th Congress, and also a member during that Congress of the Ways and Means Committee, so we were very much involved in crafting the legislation, and so it's nice to be able to talk about some of the benefits that have already accrued to citizens from the program and what they can look forward to.
Before we get into what's coming in 2014, why don't you recap a little bit what has already been implemented?
Well, some of the things that have already gone into effect I think have made enormous differences. First of all, the provision that allowed anybody who was up to age 26 to be insured on their parents' policy has made it, has brought about 2.5 million young people into the ranks of the insured. And these were many of the young people who were earlier in their careers, were not able to make enough money, or they were going to graduate school or whatever it may be, and they might have been uninsured because they had childhood asthma or juvenile diabetes or whatever it may be. They were basically uninsurable. So that's a huge benefit to American families and has saved families literally billions of dollars. Also, some of the provisions that have gone into effect for seniors have been very significant. Now seniors have saved about $500 on average in the donut hole because we've started to close that gap in prescription drug coverage. About 22 million, I think, seniors have taken advantage of free annual physicals and certain screening procedures, which have now come to them at no cost. And one of the things that I don't think as many have taken advantage of as they could have, but their subsidies have already gone into effect for small businesses to be able to help pay for part of the cost of providing insurance for their employees, up to 30% for smaller businesses with fewer than 25 employees. A lot of small businesses don't even know that that's available to them, but it was actually available on a retroactive basis. So there's an opportunity there for those who aren't aware of that. So a lot of stuff's already happening, but obviously the balance of the program goes into effect in 2014.
When you talk about the small business subsidies, is that something that you can point to when opponents say, hey, this isn't good for jobs or this isn't good for business?
You know, I've had a great time talking with small businesses in my district and elsewhere when they say, oh, this is going to hurt us. And, of course, most of them don't realize that if you don't have 50 employees, you're not even covered by the mandate. They think that they're all of a sudden going to have to pay this huge amount for insurance. They aren't aware of the tax credits that are involved for providing coverage. And the other thing that I don't think most small businesses have realized is how important this program is to allow them to keep employees even if they can't provide insurance. Because now an individual doesn't have to go to work for somebody just because they have an insurance policy. They'll be able to go out, shop in the exchanges, have their premiums subsidized, and they'll be able to stay with those companies they want to stay with without regard to whether there's health care coverage. So that's an enormous benefit for small businesses and also just in general for the economy, that people won't be tied to companies just because of health coverage.
How have your constituents in Kentucky responded to the implementation so far?
Well, a lot of them still haven't seen the impact. And what I found in the year or so that I spent going around talking to groups who were very much concerned about the health care reform, once I would get finished answering their questions, explain the various provisions and how it might affect them, they were overwhelmingly supportive. I mean, I literally would walk into rooms where 30 people were ready to string me up. And when I walked out, they said, this sounds pretty good. So it's a very hard thing to market because, unlike any other issue I'm aware of, people want to know how this affects their family, and it affects everybody differently. So nobody has the same exact healthcare situation. It's hard to market to 300 million people individually, but I think as these provisions go into effect, for instance, I meet with families all the time who have kids with juvenile diabetes or other afflictions, and they say, you know, bless you, because my child will never have to worry about being covered again, because nobody will ever be denied insurance because of a pre-existing condition.
As we know and has been stated many times, one of the largest, if not the largest, reason for a personal bankruptcy is a health care issue. Talk about how this will help offset that.
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, there are no annual limits on coverage and there are no lifetime limits. So if you get a very costly diagnosis, cancer or whatever it may be, we're averaging and still are, I assume, 700,000 or 800,000 bankruptcies a year attributable primarily to health care costs. And these are people who either don't have insurance or whose insurance was inadequate for the care that they needed. And they had no choice but to go bankrupt. That all ends with the Affordable Care Act. Again, it's a huge economic benefit, not just for those individuals, but for society, which can prevent all of these bankruptcies.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky. Congressman, this issue, as it was unfolding before the implementation and the passage of the act, was well covered. Take us through some of the behind-the-scenes issues that people may not know about, maybe some of the work that you did to really push this through.
Well, let me start by saying that this is not a perfect solution. Nobody ever said that it was. When you're trying to reform basically 18% of the economy with an enormous variety of players and participants, and again, one which affects every American citizen, you're not going to find anything perfect. So what we tried to do from day one was set some basic standards in the law. And one of the standards was nobody should be denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition. Once you start with those parameters, much of the detail in the bill was left to HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, because they have to come up with rules to implement it. The biggest thing that we know we have to do, but that nobody in Congress was capable of doing, was saying, we know we need to find a different way to compensate providers. We can't pay doctors and hospitals just for the number of procedures that they do. We have to find a different way. Well, we didn't know how to craft that. Nobody does. But we set in motion pilot programs and demonstration efforts to try and figure out better ways to compensate whatever provider it is. So we're going to be working through this for a long time. But that's kind of the process when we went through. We can't, you know, even 535 senators and House members can't figure this out. But we've got this enormous laboratory out there, and we have to move toward a different result. And we'll be making changes in this law as long as I'm around or many of us are around.
Have you found that it's almost a progress, not perfection sort of mentality, inching your way closer and closer to where you want to be?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And times will change. Demographics will change. We will have medical innovations that will radically change. I'm convinced will radically change what we do. If we cure cancer in all its forms, we've changed the whole dynamic of healthcare. If we've ended Alzheimer's, we changed the whole Medicare population. Same with diabetes. These things will happen, and we'll have to adjust. But the one thing I guess I regret about the bill was that we did not just avoid having a public option, but that we didn't have Medicare as an option. If we had said at the outset, people will be able to buy private insurance or they can buy into Medicare, it would have changed the debate because people just didn't understand what the public option was. And it was an amorphous thing. It was just a name. But if we had said Medicare was an option available to people, I think it would have been extremely popular. We would have avoided a lot of the controversy, a lot of the rhetoric. And what's interesting about it is that in the Paul Ryan proposal to change Medicare, he does do that. I mean, he says, well, you can get these public subsidies, buy private insurance, or you can stay in conventional Medicare. So there's a precedent for doing that, and I wish we had done that in the Affordable Care Act.
When you're traveling around your district and you're talking to your constituents about this law, and you meet somebody who may not necessarily agree with the implementation, when you break it down almost point by point and say, hey, you too can benefit from not being denied due to a pre-existing condition, what kind of response do you get?
I get a lot of curious looks, but then when I say, you know what I say to them, if you don't believe me, just check it out. And they say, well, if that's true, that would change my perspective. And that, I find that constantly. And, you know, people say to businesses, say to me, well, why wouldn't I just drop my insurance and pay the $2,000? And my answer is, well, you can do that now. nobody's requiring anybody to provide health care insurance. And people think that it's already such an established right that the company's obligated to do it, but they're not. And unfortunately, millions and millions of Americans have found that out the hard way. But it's understandable that people would say, yeah, well, under this you can drop private insurance, but you can do it now. This way, though, you're going to have to help subsidize that individual when he or she's out in the private market. So people tend to get in a rut and think about doing things the same way, and then it's hard for them to kind of think past their own experience. It'll take a while, but all the polls show the individual elements of this legislation, or this law, are wildly popular across the entire spectrum. It's just when you label it as Obamacare or healthcare reform, there's fear. But we'll get through that.
How does the implementation of the law play into the elections coming up this year, the presidential elections and some of the others?
If you look at polling, healthcare reform is way down the list of the priorities on which people are going to base their vote. So I'm not so sure it's going to be a major part of the campaign. If the Supreme Court does something radical, that could change the equation. Most of the people that I talk to in the judiciary say they don't think the court's going to throw the law out. So I would think in that case, it'll be rhetorical, but the people who are dead set against health care reform, who scream Obamacare, are probably never going to vote for a Democrat anyway. So I'm not sure in the final analysis it changes much. I think actually Mitt Romney, if he is the nominee, his position in endorsing a version of the Ryan plan voucherizing Medicare, I think will be very, very harmful to him in places like Florida and Arizona. So certainly you will hear about health care during the presidential campaign, but I don't think it's going to be the major turning point.
As you make your way through the conference today and then continue on for the rest of the year, what's the main point that you want to make about the Affordable Care Act?
That there is something in it for everybody, that virtually every American will be benefited by this plan, and don't believe what you hear on Fox News. There's another side of the story.
Congressman John Yarmuth from Kentucky, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion on the Affordable Care Act with Newsweek and Daily Beast contributor Eleanor Clift.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand. We've been joined by Eleanor Clift, a contributor to Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Eleanor, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
So we're joining you here today at the Families USA Health Action Conference in Washington. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, I'm here as somebody who follows politics and policy in the nation's capital, and this is a premier once-a-year conference, which has been going on for many years, promoting health care reform. And now that we've finally got it in this country, there's still plenty political fights to be waged. The Republican candidates are all running on a promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act if the Republicans do win the White House.
Why do you think this issue is so intertwined in the political conversation?
Well, I think we have an ongoing debate in this country about the role of government, and we are, I believe, the last industrialized country in the world to offer universal health care to its citizens. Presidents going back to Teddy Roosevelt have tried to achieve it and have been thwarted by the political process. And President Obama succeeded in passing and then signing the Affordable Care Act, but it took a political toll on him. And I think there's still a debate about whether it's requiring too intrusive a role of government, whether it's going to truly restrain costs or is actually going to cost more, and whether some people in the society are going to lose something in order to give to others. It's kind of an ideological debate that's being played out in our campaigns.
And is that why, in your opinion, maybe it's so divisive, why it evokes so much emotion out of people?
It's divisive because people think that government shouldn't have a role. Some people think that. Others think it is the role of government to provide this. And you also have people who have health care get worried that if it's extended to the entire population, they somehow will cost them more, or they will lose something. And the fact of requiring people to have health insurance, there's a libertarian impulse in the American public that strikes some people as an overreach of government. And that is going to be tested in the Supreme Court early this year, and that could throw a real monkey wrench into the implementation of the ACA, to use the acronym for the Affordable Care Act.
As you've gone through in your coverage of this for Newsweek and for the Daily Beast, what are people around the country saying to you about the Affordable Care Act?
People mostly just don't know what's in it and how it will affect them. And in fact, the main provisions of the Affordable Care Act don't go into effect until 2014, and that is these state-by-state exchanges or regional exchanges where people can actually shop for health care plans. I think some positive benefits have also been put in place. You can't get thrown off your insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. You can't be denied insurance, and that's really huge. And kids under the age of 26 can stay on their parents' policy, which has added a lot of young people to the health care roles. But people have digested those benefits. I don't even know if they connect them to the Affordable Care Act anymore. They think, oh, well, you know, that's happened. you know, what are you going to do for me next? But I think as the Republicans campaign on repealing the act, it's going to be very difficult. First of all, no president is a czar. He would still have to get the right numbers in Congress, and Democrats would resist mightily. And then the Congressional Budget Office has scored this bill as saving money. And so if it were to be repealed under the rules that the Republicans themselves claim to follow, they'd have to find savings somewhere else. And you would have to take away benefits that people already have, because insurance companies are not going to continue to take people with pre-existing conditions unless they begin to build the numbers of customers. And so there are a lot of moving parts to this, and I think that explains why it's so confusing and so divisive.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Eleanor Clift about the Affordable Care Act. Eleanor, do you think that come November and leading up to November, this is something that President Obama will hang his hat on and say, hey, I got this done after so many presidents tried and failed before me?
Well, I think it still surprises some people that the president really didn't claim this as a major accomplishment when he was campaigning for fellow Democrats in 2010. And I think, you know, some Democrats are angry about that, but they ran away from it, too, because at that point it was seen as a bill that went through with lots of special deals that people didn't like that, and none of the benefits were available. So it was not really seen as a positive thing. I think, you know, he will claim it. And if Mitt Romney is the Republican nominee, Mitt Romney passed a version of this in Massachusetts. And so I don't think Mitt Romney is going to want to stand up and make it a central issue of the campaign. You know, he's committed to, rhetorically at least, saying he would repeal it. But I don't think that he would challenge President Obama too much on that in fall.
And how do you see it coming into play in some of the congressional races as well?
Well, I think that more members of Congress on the Democratic side are going to be able to turn to their constituents and say, you know, these are the benefits you have. And if the Republicans elected, they want to take this away. So I think it will draw clearer lines of contrast between the candidates. And polls show that voters who overwhelmingly supported Republicans in 2010 are experiencing a bit of a buyer's remorse because it hasn't turned out like they wanted it to. And you see a lot of enthusiasm among Democrats on Capitol Hill that they may be able to regain the House. The Senate looks like a real fight there for control. And so I think, you know, it's so hard. We're in January. I feel like the politics are going to flip 2, 3, 4 times between now and November, so I hesitate to sound too authoritative on any of my predictions.
As you go about your time here at the conference, are you finding a lot of energy behind this issue moving into 2012 now?
I think the energy is a determination to protect this legislation. You have the Supreme Court committed now to rule on the constitutionality of the mandate. There's a lot of concern if the mandate were to be ruled unconstitutional, would the insurance companies live up to their end of the bargain of extending health insurance to all if they don't have the absolute commitment of people being forced to buy in? So you have that. And then you've got, we've got, 9 months of political rhetoric that's going to cast this legislation as something that is negative. And so I think the people who are here are committed to its implementation. and they want to protect this baby that they helped give birth to.
What else will you be doing leading up to the elections, coverage and things like that? What's on your agenda?
Well, I'm a political reporter mostly, and I try to think of ways to come up with new insights into how President Obama is waging his campaign and ways of looking at the Republicans as well. And then not to forget that there are other issues happening as well. I have a piece that's being posted on the Daily Beast website based on an interview with Ambassador Susan Rice. She's the ambassador to the UN, and she's being talked about as a potential Secretary of State to succeed Hillary should President Obama win a second term. So lots happens as well, and that's all going to factor into the presidential election, too.
Regarding Susan Rice, if you could maybe talk a little bit about her and why she would be a good fit in that role, succeeding Hillary as the Secretary of State.
Well, she has done a really good job at the UN. She helped put together the coalition that forced the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi from Libya. I mean, the Arab League played a role, and she went before the Security Council and got the Security Council to endorse military action. So that was big. And she's handled herself well. And she was candidate Obama's foreign policy advisor in 2008. And some people have compared that to the role that Condoleezza Rice played with George W. Bush. And when you're in on the ground floor of a campaign and you're providing advice on sensitive matters and you do well, you tend to get rewarded. And Condoleezza Rice, of course, was National Security Council, then Secretary of State. And Rice could follow in a similar path by ending up as Secretary of State. She's just 47, and she's a diplomat. You don't normally think of her as a diplomat because she's kind of blunt and outspoken. But sometimes that's what's needed in world affairs, and so. Anyway, I think she's got a bright future.
And shifting gears one more time here, as you have covered politics throughout the years, and we have seen, particularly at AFGE, sort of this attack on government, attack on federal employees, public right. services, and things like that, do you think that that's almost in line with some of the ideological attacks that have gone on against the Affordable Care Act in what government's role is and what should be?
Right. Yes, it's basically an anti-government view, and smaller government is good, bigger government is bad. It goes back. I mean, the first campaign I covered was Jimmy Carter. He ran against Washington. You know, Ronald Reagan ran against Washington. They all do. But once they get here, they generally try to temper their rhetoric and show some respect for the employees. And I think President Obama has done that. And it's one of the bones of contention now between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republicans want to pay for the extension of the payroll tax cut by cutting federal jobs, freezing federal pay, and so forth. President Obama's already frozen federal pay. I don't think he wants to punish the workforce further. And I think the political divisions tend to strengthen the political loyalties on one side or the other. And the Republicans evidently see public employees, whether they're in Washington or in state capitals around the world, as basically a Democratic constituency. And so they don't mind cutting back on their benefits and so forth. And so, and public employees respond in kind by not seeing Republicans as their allies.
And as we close out here, what are your final thoughts today?
My final thoughts today are we've gotten this far into winter, and we still haven't had any real snow, and I am grateful for that, although it's pretty darn cold out there today.
Newsweek and Daily Beast contributor Eleanor Clift, thank you for your time. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare President and CEO Max Richmond.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Max Richman, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Mr. Richman, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So here today at the Families USA Health Action 2012 conference, tell us a little bit about what you're doing this week.
Well, we, of course, are very interested in healthcare reform and a lot of discussions taking place here by various presenters on efforts in the past to improve healthcare and what lies ahead of us. And it's an important conference for an organization like ours, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, to be here and represent our nearly 3.5 million members and supporters around the country.
What are your members and supporters saying about health care reform these days?
Well, I think they're beginning to appreciate the Affordable Care Act and the benefits that it provides Medicare beneficiaries, the improvements to the Medicare program. It's taken a while for this education process to be realized. In the last 2010 election, I think a lot of members of Congress who supported the health care reform, the Affordable Care Act, were defeated, and seniors were not supporting them, because they bought into the messaging that the Affordable Care Act cut Medicare and hurt seniors, which is absolutely untrue. And now I think people are, as the benefits are being put into place and people are enjoying those benefits, they realize that there are things that happen in the Affordable Care Act that are positive for seniors, that all of the rhetoric about $500 billion being cut out of Medicare was designed to scare beneficiaries, and the truth of the act is that that amount of money, $500 billion, was saved out of Medicare, but it was saved out of providers, payments to providers and insurance companies. And that most of those savings were plowed back into the program, which is why seniors now on Medicare have preventive care with no out-of-pocket costs. That's new. The donut hole that is known by anyone who follows it or is a beneficiary is being closed over time. So they get more benefits and pay less. Get more and pay less. I don't think they got it. That message in time for the last election. We're hoping that we can help get that message out this time around.
How does Social Security fit into, and the preservation of Social Security fit into the conversation of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, Social Security is one of the pillars of retirement. It has been around since 1935. It has lifted more people out of poverty than all the other social programs combined. And then Medicare, of course, in 1965, just strengthened that retirement security, health and economics retirement security for seniors. We see a lot of myths about Social Security being used in campaigns, political campaigns, have in the past, will continue to be used. And we're, again, we're trying to separate the myth from the reality. That's our mission, one of our missions. And if we're successful at that, I think if people understand the value of the program, Medicare that I just talked about, the Affordable Care Act that I just talked about, Social Security as a family program, it's not just for retirees. A third of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers. Spouses, survivors, 4 million children get by in life because of Social Security. So we're trying to expand the knowledge about these programs to the American people.
Share a little bit more about that, separating the myth from reality. That's a really important point. And if you could maybe detail one or two areas where it's out there for public consumption but may not be completely accurate.
Well, when President Bush was reelected, the day after his reelection, we were in our conference room, our staff, in our boardroom, watching everything on television. He came out. First thing he said, I don't know if you remember this, we do because it's what we work in. He said, I have earned political capital in this election, and I'm going to use it to change Social Security. And by change, he meant privatize. And thank God we didn't succumb to that. I don't know about your 401k, but mine's about a 201k right now, getting a little bit better. But you know, we would not have been happy, American people and retirees, to see their Social Security virtually cut in half if he had succeeded in the broadest sense that he was pursuing. So, and why did he do that? He was perpetuating the myth that Social Security is broke. It's bankrupt. To me, when a program or a person is broke, there's no money there. This program has a reserve right now. That's not Max Richman saying it. It's the trustees of $2.6 trillion, which will grow another $1 trillion by the year in the next 10 years, and then will be drawn down. So according to the trustees, in 2036, there will be a shortfall if nothing is done, and only about 80% of benefits will be paid. Even then, we'll still be paying 80% of benefits for the foreseeable future. That gap is what needs to be addressed. That does not need to be done by destroying the program or decimating benefits. It can be done. We've got 25 years to have some reasonable, modest adjustments to the program to make sure it provides the kind of safety net that it has for 76 years now for far into the future.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Max Richman, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Max, if you were able to identify one key area to ensure that no shortfall happens in 2036, what would it be?
Well, I think an obvious area is to lift the cap on the amount of wages subject to the payroll tax. Right now, if you earn over $110,000 a year, you stop paying Social Security. That's a cap. It goes up a little bit each year, but that is a cap. So in other words, if you are making $100,000 a year and someone else is making $1 million a year, you're paying the same into the Social Security program. I don't think politically it's impossible to eliminate the cap altogether, but I think some adjustments could be made over time. Maybe a smaller percentage of FICA withheld at a higher level of wages, but you bring a lot of revenue into the program if you do that. Historically, 90% of wages, average wages, have been subject to payroll tax. Because of the incredible wealth that some have accumulated and are accumulating, that average is now about 82%. If we just went back to moved it back to 90% of wages subject to payroll tax, the cap might be more like 160 or 180, and that would bring a lot more revenue into the program. You know, what I find fascinating when I talk about this, and I have done hundreds of town hall meetings around the country, many of them with members of Congress, and I talk about the wage cap, a lot of people are baffled. They don't realize that there's a point at which you stop paying, because they never reach that point. So they pay withholding on FICA for whatever their annual wages are, because they almost think of it as a loophole. You mean if you make that much money, you don't pay? Why don't you pay? So I think there's a lot of untapped support for that kind of change once people are aware that there's even an issue that needs to be looked at.
Let's talk about the valuable work that the Social Security employees do to make sure that this program continues on.
Absolutely. I think they're really some of the unsung heroes in the Social Security wars that we've engaged in. I think there used to be about 80,000 employees. I think it's closer to 68 or 69,000, something like that. I'm not sure, that work for Social Security. There is a Social Security office almost wherever you live. You know, branch offices, district offices, regional offices. These employees make sure that Social Security claims are filed, applications are filed, benefits are received. If you are entitled to Social Security, you get your benefits. It is the most efficient government program we've got. The administrative cost to run this program with all these tens of thousands of employees, and the cost is paid for out of the payroll tax. It doesn't come out of any other general revenue. The cost of the benefits and the administrative costs come out of that payroll tax, is 0.9%. You could not privatize this program and have an investment company take care of the money for 0.9%. So it's very efficient. Your listeners might be interested. We have a group of volunteers. They're former Social Security employees from all over the country that really care about the program. They've retired, but they read about it. They've talked to their former associates, and they are now a core group of our volunteers that will speak for us at town hall meetings, will meet with people, and who go ahead and help someone who is a member of the National Committee and might have a problem with understanding communication from SSA, will help them walk them through whatever it might be. So we find that they're not only dedicated while they're there at Social Security, but many of them are so committed that even though they've left active employment, they reach out to us to participate as volunteers.
Lastly, Max, you mentioned before that Social Security is one of the pillars of retirement. Talk about how important this benefit is to the recipients to allow them to maintain their independence in their older years.
Well, it's more important than ever. Because the pillars, it has been talked about as a three-legged stool for retirement: Social Security, savings, and pensions. Well, pensions, we don't have too many of the kinds of pensions that we used to have. It's more and more of companies, if they provide anything, will provide a 401k, but not a pension that is guaranteed. So that leg of the stool is a little shaky, more than a little shaky. And savings, well, my gosh, look at what's happened to people's savings, their equity in their homes, if they still have a home. That's that third leg, Social Security, is bearing a lot of weight now. And the last thing in the world we need to do is start whittling away at that leg and making it less sturdy. Because people are counting on it now, if not as much, they may be counting it even more for their retirement security.
Max Richmond, the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Max, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you to our guests this week, Congressman John Sarbanes and John Yarmuth, Newsweek and Daily Beast contributor Eleanor Clift, and National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare President and CEO Max Richmond. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD.